This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscow-Aim. Back in December 2009, I first interviewed Laura Fatal about her son Josh, who had been arrested and charged with espionage by the Iranian government. He and two friends, Shane Bauer and Sarah Shurd, had been hiking in the Kurdistan region of Iraq and had strayed into Iranian territory. They were imprisoned in the notorious Evin prison in Tehran, where they were interrogated, held in solitary confinement for Sarah more than 400 days. Shane and Josh were sentenced to 8 years in prison. Their case received worldwide attention. Sarah was released in 2010, followed by Josh and Shane a year later in a deal negotiated by the Omani government. They have collaborated on a book about what happened to them, titled A Sliver of Light, and they join us on Radio Times. Shane Bauer is an investigative journalist, and Shane, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Josh Fatal getting his PhD at NYU. Josh, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having us.
And Sarah Shurd is a writer, educator, contributing editor at Solitary Watch. And Sarah, nice to have you with us as well.
It's great to be here.
I'm sure you've been asked this question many, 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 many times. I'm going to ask it anyway. Why were you hiking so close to the Iran border? I'll put that to you, Shane.
Well, Sarah and I had been living in Syria for about a year. I had spent a few years in the Middle East by that time. I speak Arabic, and I'd for a while been trying to entice Josh to come out and visit. We were good friends before this, and another good friend both came to visit us in Syria, and we decided to take a little trip. I had worked in Iraq in the past in Baghdad. You know, it's obviously a war zone, but Iraqi Kurdistan isn't. It's a safe place. No American had ever been injured there. You know, we had read kind of write-ups in the Atlantic and New York Times. It was actually later in 2001 called one. It was one of the top 41 places to visit in the world in the New York Times. So we took this trip to Kurdistan, and we wanted to get out of the city one day, and we asked if there was a place to go. We asked our hotel manager, and he and other people told us to go to this place where there was a waterfall. And we went there, the three of us, and there was kind of a lot of Kurdish families there camping out, hundreds of people, and we went on a hike early one morning, and we hiked quite far. We didn't realize unfortunately, how close we were to the Iranian border, and we saw some guards who waved us over to them, and we assumed that they were Iraqi Kurdish soldiers, and we went to them, you know, expecting they would ask us what we're doing, maybe tell us to turn back, and we found out when we got there they're Iranian, and you
had crossed over the border. I mean,
yeah.
You had ended up crossing into Iran.
Right. Yeah. After we crossed, after they detained us, one of the guards spoke a little bit of English, and we asked him where the border was. You know, it was unmarked, and he pointed to the trail that we were walking on. So in going to them, we crossed the border.
Do you think it was naive? I mean, it with the advantage of hindsight.
I think it was, you know, it was a mistake, you know, to not be, you know, we didn't know we were near the Iranian border. That was the problem. You know, I think I don't think it was naive for us to be in Iraqi Kurdistan. There's 2 million tourists a year go there. You know, it's a nice place, and right. And I would still go there and recommend other people to go there.
I think it was, and I should say to our listeners that each of you wrote different chapters in this book, and I think it was in one of your chapters, Sarah, where one of the guards says to you, you came here for vacation. I mean, they were, I think, pretty shocked that three Americans would be vacationing in this part of Iraq and then obviously ending up in Iran.
I think, yeah, that guard was Layla, who was one of my, she was my favorite guard. She was really tough, but she also had a really soft side. We could speak Arabic together, so we communicated better than others. And she said, "I know you were just here for sport, in the Zagros Mountains." And actually, the guards were really proud of the beauty of Iran. You know, of the natural beauty, and that extends into Kurdistan. So they were actually they would boast about it, and they can understand why someone would want to spend time there.
But I have to say, I mean, it sounded pretty scary to be essentially arrested, taken by these guards. I'm looking at you, Josh, and put in a car and driven, eventually accused of espionage.
Yeah. Well, it was almost, you know, when guards would ask, they would, a lot of the time throughout, even towards the end of my detention there, they would say, well, what do you think of Iran? Isn't it? It's beautiful. What do you? They had so much pride in their country.
Right.
And it seemed beautiful. You know, the mountains were beautiful. And on the drive from Western Iran on the border to Tehran, it looked very beautiful. But I had to, it was a tough question to answer because, you know, my experience in Iran was from the border to a prison.
Sure,
wasn't the most pleasant. But the thing was, I did experience many Irans, and perhaps we'll talk about that later, of all the different, you know, good and bad guards and interesting encounters we had with other prisoners. But
we will talk about all of that. I'm just trying. Yeah, I'm trying to put myself into your place and imagine what it would be like, especially to be accused of espionage.
Well, it was, you know, we didn't know exactly, you know, what the charges would be and how it would go. And at first, it seemed like perhaps we would just get released. And I remember actually on the ride down from the mountain, they put us in a car and we drove down the mountain and we immediately went to a police station. Well, they immediately bought a hijab for Sarah.
That's right.
Because we were so, you know, not prepared to be in Iran. But then they took us to a police station, and at that police station there was a man there who kind of like went off on this little bit of a tirade about how Americans had detained these Iranians in Iraq and how they had kept them for over 2 years, and he was like yelling about 2 years, can you believe it? And I remember like not having heard of this and kind of just feeling like, how is that relevant? Like, I wouldn't get caught up in that story of the conflict between the American-Iranian government. I have nothing to do with that.
Yeah, but apparently...
That was just day one.
Exactly, day one. I have interviewed people who have been in Evin prison in Tehran, and it's a place where, I guess, where criminals go, where political prisoners go. Mm-hmm. It sounds like a pretty frightening place. Could you describe it for our listeners?
Yeah, well, Evin prison is a very large prison, and we didn't even know that we were in Evin prison for months. We were blindfolded and brought there. But the places that we were in, two different parts of Evin prison, both were political prisons. They were, you know, the people that were there were pro-democracy activists, people that were part of unpopular faiths, maybe professors who had said something the government didn't like abroad. They're in, everyone's in isolation who's a political prisoner. You know, either they're in solitary confinement or they're in a cell with other inmates, but they can't interact. They're not allowed to interact with other prisoners, and when they leave the cell, they're blindfolded. When they're interrogated, they're in soundproof rooms, blindfolded. And you know, we heard at times devastating screams, and you know, we would manage to sneak conversations with other prisoners in neighboring cells, and some of them, you know, told me that they had had their hair pulled out, that they had been beaten, that someone told Josh that he had been electrocuted.
Wow. I mean, that's scary. And your descriptions of what was going on around. And let me go back to you, Sarah, this sort of happened at the same time that there had been protests on the street. So so I'm assuming the Iranian government, the guards, the police were kind of on edge because of that.
Mm, yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. We assumed that the protests had died down. The sort of climax was a few months before we were captured, and we hadn't heard anything else about it, but of course we hadn't heard much about anything. Mm. But there was another protest called the Ashura protests that happened in December of 2009, and I had a sense that it was coming. The guards were tense. There was a box full of new prison uniforms and the plastic sandals they had us wear at the end of the hallway, and I thought, well, is there going to be an influx? Mm. And then the day of Ashura, there had also been intimations on the television, veiled threats by the Iranian government towards hooliganism, what they often called the protesters. And the day that the Ashura protests happened, I heard helicopters flying outside in Tehran all day. And then that night, the prison filled with prisoners. There were probably, I don't know, 8 or 9 women in each cell in my corridor. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were bloody. They'd been beaten. They came fresh from the streets. And that was the beginning of kind of a new era, because I had a chance to interact with a lot of those women and learn their stories.
As you described, there were not surprisingly good guards. There were also guards that were really lovely and humane, including one that said to you, when you had this whole interaction with her, she said, I love you.
Rasavi,
she said to you that.
Yeah, that was an important lesson for me pretty early on, because in the early weeks, there was no way to orient myself. I had absolutely nothing to compare that experience to. And with the guards, she just was so young and beautiful and lively and sweet. She used to open just the little window on my cell door every night as I was falling asleep, and she would just say all these, I couldn't understand Farsi, but it sounded like she was just telling me goodnight and saying all these sweet things to me before she went home. And I started to grow attached to her, and one day I lost control and started crying and really had my first breakdown. And she came into my cell and pulled me up from the floor and threw her arms around me, which that was, there was only one other time that a guard ever came into my cell. That's putting themselves really in a vulnerable position. And she took me out to the open air room, and we walked around in circles, and she started stomping on the leaves in a really playful way and inviting me to join her. And it was just incredible to me that she could be so joyful.
Yeah.
But it was also very twisted, because just a few weeks later, I heard the most brutal sound I'd ever heard. I mean, I'll never know what was happening to that man, but it was, you know, the scream of anguish. Just, there's nothing I've heard that comes close to it. And she came to my cell, and she told me that they were playing football. And I knew she was lying, but she said it with a big smile. And it just sunk in that she's okay with this. She works in this place.
The two of you shared a cell. I mean, you did spend time in solitary, but you did share a cell and managed to sort of create activities and things that could keep you occupied.
Indeed, and I just wanted to add about the timing of our arrest. You know, there was all these protests, as Sarah mentioned, and it's like, it seems to be universal that whenever there's a protest and that the government that's being protested says that it's started by outsiders. And so that became the fear. And I remember when we met the Swiss ambassador after a couple months, and she represents U.S. interests in Iran because the U.S. doesn't have an embassy there. And she said, you know, the timing of your arrest is not good. And so that became kind of the worry. Right. And a few months later, when we got put together, Shane and I, it was at first such a relief because, you know, sometimes the best pleasure in life is just relief from pain, and that's what happened in the beginning of when Shane and I were together, because that was the end of total solitary confinement for us.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Much more to talk about. That's Joshua Fatal, who joined us along with Shane Bauer and Sarah Shurd. And they have co-authored a book. It's called A Sliver of Light, and it's subtitled Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. You probably remember their case, their story. It had a lot of coverage on the news. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra salutes the Britain Centennial. Donald Runicles conducts the Sea Interludes from Peter Grimes. Janine Jansen plays the Violin Concerto. And Runicles conducts the Linz Symphony by Britain's beloved Mozart. Tickets at philorc.org or 215-893-1999. March 27th, 28th, and 29th at the Kimmel Center. Mozart and Benjamin Britten with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. If you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes on our show, here's your chance to find out. On a special Fresh Air broadcast, Friday, March 28th, our producers and I will answer your questions about how we put the show together. To submit your questions, go to the website whyy.org/askfreshair. That's whyy.org/askfreshair. So tell us what you want to know, then tune in March 28th.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, Michelle Obama joins the ranks of first ladies traveling to China.
It is time for us to say here in Beijing that it is no longer acceptable to discuss women's rights as separate from human rights.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1, on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatal, and Sarah Sher. They're the three Americans who were held in an Iranian prison after unknowingly crossing the Iraq-Iran border, and they tell their story in this new book called A Sliver of Light. Again, Shane Bauer, Josh Fatal, and Sarah Short, our guests. Sarah, you were in solitary confinement for more than 400 days.
Mm-hmm.
And you have many chapters and many descriptions in this book about what it was like for you. And the way you describe it is that it was torture.
Yeah. In the early weeks and months, I couldn't sleep. I was just constantly in a panic attack. And I would pace my cell compulsively. I would crouch by the small slot, the food slot in the cell door, just trying to hear any sounds, whether it's footsteps or other prisoners coughing, to orient myself in the world.
Did you have nothing in the cell, essentially, to occupy your mind?
In the beginning, no. There was no bed. It was just an empty cell with a blanket.
No book.
They let us, after a few weeks, they let us have the book that we brought with us, and they passed it back and forth between the three of us, and we read that book many, many times. The solitary confinement slows down your brain. Studies have shown that after 2 to 3 days, the brainwaves shift towards stupor or delirium. So it's really trying to keep yourself on track, keep yourself vigilant. I would recite multiplication tables in my head. I would sing songs at the top of my lungs. But there were times that I couldn't fight it any longer, that I was overwhelmed by depression and rage, and I screamed and even beat at the walls of my cell. But the majority of time was spent just really exercising, keeping myself disciplined. And there were beautiful moments. There were always things that brought me back from the edge of sanity. Mm. There's, in the book, I describe waking up early one morning, and the sliver of light from my window came into my cell, and there were all these dust motes
floating in the air.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. I was overwhelmed by a sense of beauty. It reminded me of the beauty of the world. It was like a microcosm, and every dust mote was a different person from my life, and I had a sense of peace that even if I never got out of that cell, the world would go on without me, and it was a beautiful world.
Did you think you were going to lose your mind, or did you feel at times you were losing your mind?
Yeah. I think everyone that I've talked to that goes through prolonged solitary confinement has times where they either lose their mind or get very close. It's just a matter of, can you get back? And eventually, when I had too many breakdowns and the interrogators were afraid I was going to hurt myself, and I beat at the walls of my cell, they gave me time with Shane and Josh in the open air cell that we called Hava Hori, which means eating fresh air.
Mm.
And that became my lifeline. Everything, it gave me something to look forward to every single day. I was still in solitary confinement because the UN says that anything from 22 to 23 hours alone is solitary confinement. And of course, 15 days, according to the UN, can cause permanent psychological damage and constitute torture. And I was in for 410 days. Shane and Josh were in for over 4 months. So we were all psychologically tortured.
Do you feel like you were psychologically damaged by what happened there?
Well, yeah. It took years.
Even today?
I'm pretty much back to the new normal.
New normal, right.
I've been able to really turn my experience into something positive. The work that I do with prisoners in solitary confinement in this country, writing our book, Shane and I have walked each other through every step of the process of recovery, but not everyone does recover.
Yeah. Shane, go ahead.
Yeah, there were times that, after Josh and I got put back together, we were allowed to see Sarah for a period of time each day in this kind of open-air cell, and there were times that I thought that Sarah was not going to be the same person when she got out. I remember, especially when Josh and I first got put together, it was just this kind of a, there was a relief to being with Josh, but in a way it was worse because Sarah was still alone, and I remember going out to the cell, open air cell one day, and Sarah just had this look of total devastation in her face, and she started just kicking the wall, and I physically grabbed her and pulled her away, and it was like restraining her, and trying to calm her down, and so these violent outbursts, but there were also, as the months passed, this kind of withering away of her. And Josh and I were just kind of constantly trying to figure out how to bring her out of that. And, you know, fortunately, she got out after a year.
Well, in fact, Sarah, you write in the book, ever since I found out that Shane and Josh were put together, I've been full of uncontrollable anger at everything and at everyone, and hate, almost violent hate. I feel like I have lost them. I mean, the thought that they were together, but you were alone, even for the, and you had this, what, an hour something a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I knew it was completely out of their control and that I couldn't blame them. But you battle with a lot of inner demons. Mm-hmm. And that's the process. And that's ultimately what I think saved me, is that it became, we realized together that everything we did had to be resistance to those conditions, so that we wouldn't become that place, so we wouldn't be institutionalized. So I hated the fact that the guards could always look through a peephole and see me. So I started to cover the peephole with blue shampoo so they couldn't see me anymore, and they'd right. wipe it off and I'd just put it back on. And there are a million little ways we found to resist those conditions.
Including hunger strikes. I mean, you would go on hunger strikes to protest mm-hmm. things.
Yeah, we actually, when we were coming across the country before we were brought to Evin prison, we all decided that if we were separated, we would go on hunger strike until they put us back together. And it didn't. Ultimately, they gave us, you know, a meal together, which at that time, just, you know, 5 days apart, was such a relief to see each other and know that we were okay, the other people were okay. And then later, after throughout solitary confinement, I had gone on a couple of hunger strikes, and then after Sarah was released, Josh and I kind of got into a routine of hunger strikes where we wouldn't, after Sarah got out, they kind of you know, they weren't as vigilant with us. They wouldn't bring us letters from family, and we would you know, we're constantly on hunger strikes just to get those letters mm-hmm. and that kind of news from the outside.
Josh, this goes back to I guess some of the earlier time in Evin, but you talk about finding a pen full of ink, and you also write, the written word has become my closest friend. The fact that you could write something.
Being able to write allowed me.
And you're writing now during the hour, I noticed.
I'm writing during the hour.
You are. You've got pens and pens.
Many of them.
You do. It's okay. I've been watching you. It's okay.
It's not PT. It maybe is PT. No, I don't know if it's PTSD.
Well, whatever. It's fine. It's fine. I just could not notice.
Yeah, no, actually, I just bought these yesterday. I thought they were gorgeous. And, you know, writing was, it was a way to be able to see myself, to be able to have a conversation. I was having no conversations. And that was the miserable part, to just have zero conversations in a day. I remember that's why I would look forward to interrogation. I mean, interrogation was horrible, but I wanted it because at least I could have a conversation. In the first 30 days, the guards would, when they would come to give me food or anything, they would just slip it to me without letting me see them anything beyond their hand. And then after 30 days, they started, I began being able to have at least, you know, often a conversation in charades, to be able to communicate between languages. But writing became that for me. It became a way, at least I could talk to myself. And when we got a couple books, it was, then I could talk to authors, even if they were in 19th century Russia or the past or some other time. The mind just started to dull down. And I remember rooting, wanting guards to come, even if they were going to be mean to me.
Because, just to have an interaction.
Because it was better than, it was at least emotion. I felt like my mind is just getting dull. And I don't know, I don't know if this is like, you know, some sort of enlightened state of no thinking, or yes. just plain slow death, as Sarah calls it. Mm. And it clearly wasn't enlightenment.
No. I mean, were you almost afraid that you would disappear? I mean, the you that
the
is
sense.
You?
Yeah. And that's why for me, it was about part of my resistance, and part of the way I coped was an attempt to try to find different parts of myself within such a limited environment. And whether then I was becoming, had moments of like trying to hold guards' hands in the hallway just to like play with them, I had a sort of playful wrestling match with one of the guards. So it was sort of different tactics to just feel like, oh, okay, right, there's such a thing in the world as sort of joking, or there's such a thing in the world as, of course, you know, refusing to put the blindfold down, which was kind of the everyday argument mm-hmm. that I would have with the guards.
I remember a time when we were all in solitary confinement, and we met with the Swiss ambassador, who was the kind of stood in for the U.S. And that was the first time that we had all seen each other in quite a while. And at that meeting, Josh whispered to me that he had stolen a pen from the guards and that he would leave it in the open air cell outside in the garbage can, and I would get it. And so he did that and had a letter in it. And I went back to my cell and read this letter and then wrote a letter back to him. And we eventually, you know,
I remember exactly what I told Sarah.
What did it say? You remember what it said?
I mean, I remember some of the very explicit details Shane writing about opening the how he opened the sunflower seeds that he got from the guards. And
some commentaries on Dostoevsky's The Idiot.
Where, because the bathrooms are at the end of the hall and you don't want to... you have to go there, you have to ring the button, and the guard has to take you, so sometimes you can't go immediately. So Shane wrote that he pees in his sink, and I, of course, was already peeing in my sink. So.
But I remember before that, I was kind of really in this place where I would kind of lay in my bed, and it was really hard for me some days just to get up. And there would be times that a neighbor in my in the other cell would pound on the wall, and that would kind of get me moving, and I'd pound back. But it was such a struggle. But when I got that letter and then I wrote back, I was suddenly like just flowing with energy again, just being able to write my thoughts and know that somebody would read them. And we did that for a little while. Sarah, we managed to tell Sarah about it. And then they caught us. And that month after that was probably the worst month in prison, because we were just, the interrogators never came. We never saw each other. They wouldn't tell us anything. And we didn't know what was going to happen or when we would talk to anyone again.
And that's Shane Bauer, who joins us along with Joshua Fatale and Sarah Shord. Their book is called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. It's probably a story you're familiar with, although it has not been told by the three people who lived it. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at Marty Moss. This is a question for all of you, because you were accused of being spies for the United States, which was not true, and yet you were in a situation where either you weren't believed or you couldn't go to a court to sort of prove your innocence. And I wonder, perhaps to you, Sarah, just how that also just made your imprisonment so difficult, because it felt like there was no way out.
My interrogator told me he knew I was innocent from the beginning.
And which might create a whole other set of problems.
Well,
right?
Yeah, because I thought for a while I believed him and I trusted him, and I regretted that immensely. I think a lot of the interrogators and guards, particularly their good behavior, is they're really just trying to make themselves feel better. They probably have a tremendous amount of guilt for working in a place like that when they know that they're torturing and imprisoning innocent people. And in the beginning, it was a horrible feeling to think that the other women in the prison would think that I was guilty, you know, would believe the lies their government said about me. And it was such an incredible relief the first time an older woman, there were two really older women in the cell next to mine, and once on my way to the bathroom, I darted over to their cell and looked into a peephole, and I saw that the two of them were sleeping on the floor. They didn't even have a bed, and these were women in their 60s or 70s. And, It's such a comfort to know that there are people around you going through what you're going through, and then to find out that they don't hate you, that they in fact love you, is psychologically very nice. So she passed by my cell, and I put my hand through the bars, and she grabbed my hand, and she said, just wait. And she said, your mother is fighting for you. I saw your mother, you know, just wait. And every one of those interactions, and there were dozens and dozens, was... you know, changed everything. Like Shane was saying, getting a small note from Josh, it would be days that I'd just be elated. It was kind of a feeling of like falling in love.
Sure.
Just being filled with the essence of another human being.
Well, and we should say, and I opened by talking about your mother, Josh Fatale, but there was a big campaign in this country led in part by your families and friends to free the hikers, as it was called. I don't know if you like that being referred to as hikers. But nonetheless, there was outside of this prison this whole campaign going on. Did you in any way know what was going on?
Yeah, we didn't. At first, we had no idea if what anybody knew. And the first time that we... I got a glimpse of it was when I was first allowed to sit with Sarah and Josh alone without a guard or an interrogator, And Josh told us that he had met another prisoner who briefly had a brief interaction where he said, "You're one of the hikers." And that really hit us, me and Sarah, I think, because it was like, okay, we have a name. So that means that there's some, it just was such a sign that there was something happening on the outside. We were in the media. Mm-hmm. And then we started getting letters from family, and they were always telling us about what they were doing. There were details they withheld because they knew the letters were being read. But
sure.
But we did have a sense. And eventually we were given a television. And I remember the first day we got a TV, it was probably about 6 months in. The first day we turned it on and saw ourselves on TV. It was CNN, and I saw these pictures of Sarah and Josh streaming, and it was such a crazy experience for me because it felt like I was watching myself, like after I died, kind of.
Right.
It was like this retrospective.
This person named Shane
Bauer,
right? Yeah,
it was kind of this feeling like this person is gone, and I'm there watching it.
Was that pain? I mean, that sounds painful.
It was. It was painful, and it was also heartening in a weird way because I just knew that something, you know, there was a tension, at least.
Well, Josh, as I said, I interviewed your mom, your brother. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was this campaign going on to try to get you free.
Yeah, well, I'm proud and grateful for you to allow me to sit here in the seat that my mother and brother have sat in now, trying to get me free and now being free. And I know it was an international campaign, and Philadelphia was huge. I just have to say, like, coming back here.
Well, you grew up here.
I grew up here, and coming here, it feels like home, and people really pulled together. Like when we came back, just briefly, when I got back, I had this big party that was, like, really overwhelmingly amazing, because people really cared for me and pulled together. And I just would like to say that, you know, one of the individuals that was, my family was at the center of it here in Philadelphia, but one of the other individuals in Philadelphia was Brian Gralnick, who's running mm-hmm. for state senate, and he's, I think he was on your show earlier doing, advocating about food stamp issues. And so the network here became, you know, crucial also for my release and coming back and feeling supported.
Yeah, and we're almost up on a break here, but I do want to talk about reentry for all of you. But for you, Josh, and coming back to this party, was that disorienting to sort of, and we'll talk about sort of all the processes of getting you all out of prison, but nonetheless, that first kind of contact with your past.
Yeah, it was extremely overwhelming, but it was also just so warm. I mean, the overwhelming feeling of prison, wherever it is, it's like this coldness, this sort of bare bones, you know, there's no warmth, there's no hugs, there's just so little, there's just, every time, if I just ask for, you know, toothpaste in prison, the guard just looks at me and goes, no, you know, like, roughly, you know, it's just like, it's all rough, and so coming back to the warmth was nice.
Let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We have some calls coming in as well. And that's Joshua Fatal, who joins us along with Sarah Short and Shane Bauer, co-authors of A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. And again, calls coming in, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia and the Main Line by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at iamconcerned.org.
It isn't easy finding good gluten-free breads, cakes, and cookies. So by popular demand, the cooks at America's Test Kitchen started experimenting to see if they could devise recipes that would taste as good as the wheat versions. Their favorite gluten-free recipes are in their new gluten-free cookbook. We'll talk with the editors Jack Bishop and Julia Collin-Davison on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Little English majors.
His name is Fred.
His name is Fred.
In a classroom in Portland, Oregon, teachers teach English as a first and a second language. How language is leading to learning and teaching in new ways. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Sarah Short. She's a writer, educator, contributing editor at Solitary Watch. Josh Fatal is getting his PhD at NYU, lives in Brooklyn. Shane Bauer is an investigative journalist. And again, all three of them written this book, A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Shane, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, we were talking earlier about the campaign that our family started, and it's really became kind of an international campaign. There were times where some people in our families were kind of growing frustrated with the lack of they didn't feel like they were getting anywhere with our own government. There was such a diplomatic deadlock, and there was not really any political will to kind of reach out to Iran in any way, which is what it ultimately took to get us out. So they start going to other countries. Venezuela was brought in. Sarah got in touch with Sean Penn after she got out, and he brought in the late President Hugo Chavez, who contacted Ahmadinejad. Oman played a major role. They ultimately paid $1.5 million of bail money to get us out. Iraq, Turkey, a lot of Iran's allies really were essential because they could kind of Iran's allies, that they could kind of convince, Iran to move on our case.
But did you really expect the U.S. government, I mean, whether it's a good or bad thing or not, because of its very difficult and contentious relationship with Iran, to negotiate directly for your release?
I didn't expect it, no. And I would tell my interrogator this, he would, they told us at some point, that they wanted to do a prisoner exchange. First we heard about it, and then our interrogators kind of start talking about it. And I would tell them, the U.S. doesn't really do this. I would try to convince them that there's not going to be anything that's going to come of this.
Well, go ahead, Josh.
And just, the way our families moved, which was so energetic from the get-go to get us out and so impressive. And when we would find this out in prison, it would always be like waves of relief would come over us. And then we wouldn't believe it a week later. We're like, are they really having vigils in 30 cities and 15 countries or something? And they went, it was a media campaign. It was U.S. government as much as that was going to happen. But then it was international. And within a couple months, they would just go down D.C., go down to D.C. and go to like every embassy petitioning them to put in a word for us.
Well, and I'll just quote what Hillary Clinton said at the time when she was Secretary of State. Obviously, we appeal to the Iranian leadership to release these three young people and free them as soon as possible. We consider this a totally unfounded charge, the charge of espionage. There's no basis for it. They were out hiking and unfortunately, apparently, allegedly walked across an unmarked boundary.
I heard a similar statement from Hillary Clinton a few months into prison because my neighbors had the television on and they turned it up because they knew I was next to them and they wanted me to hear. And at first I was like, okay, good, people know about us, this is like a good thing. Later, when we met with the Omani envoy who visited us in prison and became the negotiator for our release and who flew us out of Iran, he would say, Hillary, every time she says something like this, it's bad diplomacy. We have to work. Every time it says that means you're not going to get out for a while, and so.
And that's part of this very convoluted, complicated.
It's part of a greater politics of isolating Iran. As part of a greater politics, and it was. I wish we would have been separated from that, but we weren't. We were part of it.
It took a lot of guts on behalf of our families to. I mean, there was the sort of public face of the campaign, the beautiful candlelight vigils and all of the signs, but the brilliant strategy that they devised behind the scenes not only took a lot of many people giving a lot of advice and them sort of taking the best possible route, but it took a lot of guts. I mean, my mom, in my case, decided to use the fact that there was some kind of concern around health problems. But I had a clean bill of health. My mother knew that. The Iranian government knew that. But that was a specific strategy for the Iranian government to save face and release me and ease international pressure and not look weak on the U.S. So we really had to the families. And then in Shane and Josh's case, when I was on the outside, it took us many months because there's a real fear that anything you could do could make things worse. And that was the advice that we got from a lot of diplomats, mm-hmm. including the U.S. government. You know, just don't rock the boat. It'll end eventually. But our families wouldn't take that answer. They wouldn't sit by passively and wait for this to be done.
Well, I can't imagine families, you know, ever wanting to do that.
Yeah.
And you were released on what they called humanitarian grounds.
Yeah, that's what they called it. But, you know, it was a very self-serving strategy on behalf of the Iranian government because they were going to be going to the U.N. General Assembly in New York, and they get a lot of criticism around human rights, so they wanted to look a little bit better by releasing me.
Well, you even describe a meeting that you had with Ahmadinejad.
Yeah.
In New York.
Yeah, just a week after my release, I went from spending time in Oman to Oprah, and then I met with President Ahmadinejad and Obama within 24 hours. As far as I know, no one else has ever done that in history, met with the U.S. and Iranian governments, or presidents in the same day. But the President Ahmadinejad, he didn't want to look at me. You know, he decided to do the meeting, but he was just talking to my mother and making a lot of small talk, but I forced him to lock eyes with me. And once he did, he said, you know, I know this is wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, you guys are good kids.
Is that a quote?
Yeah.
And there was some sort of conflict between the courts, I guess, in Iran and, mm-hmm. and Ahmadinejad about sort of what to do with you, or I guess what to do with the two of you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a similar kind of lack of political will inside Iran as there is in the U.S. government. The State Department, the White House didn't agree on what to do, what they were willing to do. In order to get Shane and Josh out, and it was similar inside Iran. You know, politics are dirty.
I think there was also a kind of a legitimacy issue. There were times in the prison where, I remember asking why we were held in solitary confinement so long, why we couldn't get out, and guard said to me, well, what about Guantanamo? How long are they in solitary there? Josh and I didn't go to trial for 2 years, and we would say, why don't you take us to trial? You know, if you think we're guilty, take us to trial. And they would say, well, how long do people wait before they go to trial in Guantanamo? So then later, when we were hearing on television Secretary Clinton calling for us to go to trial, there's kind of an issue of, well, do you have the legitimacy to kind of make this demand when there are people that have been held for mm-hmm. some for 10 years or more that haven't been charged or taken to trial?
Although, I mean, it should be said that President Obama wants to do that.
Right.
I mean, he's just been sort of blocked by Congress and the ability to bring those people over to the mainland to go through trial. I don't want to get so deep into that. But let me ask you, because it was the Omani, the government of Oman that helped your release. I think it was like $1.5 million,
yeah.
Something like that. And I was just curious. I just went to Human Rights Watch just to sort of check out what they have to say about the Omani government. I know how political in the best sense of the word, how political the three of you are, and their human rights record is not that particularly stellar. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that raised... I'm looking at you, Josh, but all three of you raise sort of conflicts about dealing with a government that maybe doesn't treat its people particularly well.
It was hard to, we weren't getting, I didn't know much about Oman before before I flew on an Omani jet to yeah. freedom. And, I did hear that there was, when the Arab Spring erupted, we were in prison. And that was happening across the board. And then in the Iranian news, we heard about all the countries that were toppled, all the governments that were toppled that were sympathetic to the U.S. And that we didn't, so Bahrain, Egypt, Tunisia, these countries that were friends with the U.S. were getting toppled. Of course, when we got out, we don't hear about, we only hear about the, we don't hear about Bahrain and the countries that are being, that are ally, have a relationship with Iran. So, like Syria, for instance, was not well reported on, obviously. So what we heard about Oman was very skewed at the time. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know if you guys have anything to add about this, but...
It's complicated.
Yeah,
It is.
I mean, of course, we were grateful for anything that any government was willing to do to get us out.
Right. And, like Oman everybody's...
Really Oman really tied our case in with the larger picture mm-hmm. of U.S.-Iranian diplomacy. We found out late last year that the meetings that the Omani government arranged between high-level U.S. officials and Iranian officials on Omani soil opened around our case opened up the doors for diplomacy that led to the recent nuclear deal, that, you know, historic nuclear deal. And I think that it's wrong to use people, whether you're doing it for something good or something bad. It's wrong to use people as pawns. But all, you know, all governments do it, as far as I know. I mean, there may be a few exceptions, but and that's why I say that really where diplomacy failed in our case, an international campaign succeeded, and we wouldn't have gotten out without that pressure, because the governments have much larger agendas. You know, we were very small pieces in the puzzle for them.
Well, let me get to some of our callers. We have, it looks like, Reed from Chestnut Hill to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Reed. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I actually graduated from the same high school as Josh and remember the campaign growing from bumper stickers just locally in Elfrid Park in Cheltenham, where we're both from. And then growing to the point where it was all over Philadelphia. And I was wondering, for all three of you, the definition of home and how that really changed for you during the course of time that you were, you know, that you were in jail. How did that definition of home change for you? And also, once you were finally home, what was that first real moment of peace or moment that you felt like you were finally home after, I guess, all the madness of a kind of everybody saying hello to you and all this
right business. And all the publicity as well. Reed, thanks for the call. Josh, let me toss that first to you.
Well, one of the things I spent a lot of time thinking about in solitary confinement was Iraq. Actually, is where my father was born, and so going back there, in a way, there was a relation. It was a sort of home relationship to that region of the world. He's not there. He moved to Israel. He moved to the United States from there, and that's where I was born. But in some sense, the search for home, such a sort of quintessential American search,
yes,
is part of what moved me. And being in prison, it was clearly that wasn't my home. And coming back, I wasn't sure, you know, what would be my new home. And because home for me isn't, you know, the continental United States or the sort of geographical politics. It's family. It's friends. It's the places I know. And I moved to Brooklyn last year, and after I found an apartment, which is not easy in New York City.
No, it's not. Not at all.
I sort of coincidentally found out that apartment was the same place my great-grandfather had lived. When he had returned to the United States after World War II, just totally coincidentally.
That's your home now.
And that's where my... And so I have a seven-month-year-old child, and that's his first sort of home. And so in a way, that sort of full circle feels like I'm settling in.
Yeah, how about for... And I should say to our listeners, the two of you are married, so
we
you share a home.
Yeah. Yeah.
Shane, and then I do want to get back
to
some...
Well, what comes
home
to mind is one of the first books that I was given by our interrogators was Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, and I just really lived inside of that book for a while, memorized his poems, thought about, you know, the geography, the sweeping plains, all of that, And so I appreciated home in that sense, but also being in a political prison alongside all these people who were being punished for kind of, you know, what they were fighting for, really kind of deepened my appreciation for a lot of our history. And, you know, I thought about people like Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Harriet Tubman, and just felt so proud to be from this place, this country that just has such a rich history of dissent that has led to such beautiful change and meaningful change.
Let me get a caller in, and I'll put it to you, Sarah. This is Chris calling us from Frankfurt. Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I hope you can hear me.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, very, very basically, an obvious question is, did your captors actually believe? Because I'm sure to me and to most people probably listening here, it would have seemed like a device or a political reason or whatever, but did they actually believe that you were spies and that you were involved in espionage? Was that something that they really regarded you as? And I'll take, you know, listen off the air.
Sure, Chris. Yeah, thanks. Sarah, I'm tossing that to you.
Yeah, I feel very strongly that they never did. I mean, but then again, how can you get inside another human being's mind really, you know, deeply? Was there a seed of you know, of belief, it's very possible. I don't know that it really matters, because whether we were guilty or not, we were held as political hostages, political pawns. But a lot of those interrogators are in such an insular world, and they're fed with so much propaganda. They wanted so badly to believe that maybe they could have convinced themselves, but they had no reason to believe it. They had absolutely no evidence.
But they told us after 2 months that they knew that we weren't spies. You know, we'd gone through interrogation, and I think, you know, they were probably convinced long before these 2 months, but after 2 months, it was absolutely clear, you know, based on what they told us, that they knew that we weren't spies, and they said that our situation had become political, and that it was really an issue between their government and our government, and we were going to have to wait until they sorted it out.
Can you go back to Iran?
No, we're convicted spies. I'm a convicted spy.
Right. I'm actually out on bail. So
exactly.
We all are. You're all. Technically.
Yeah. Well, it's been very interesting. And my thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. And again, our guests have been Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatal, and Sarah Shord. And their book is called A Sliver of Light, and it's subtitled Three Americans Imprisoned in Iraq. Shane Bauer is an investigative journalist. Josh Fatal is getting his PhD at NYU. Sarah Shord is a writer, educator, a contributing editor at Solitary Watch. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. In fact, you can carry on a conversation on our homepage. You can check us out on Facebook and Twitter, and of course, download the podcast. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you so much for joining us.